Session number 16714, Richard Forbes, Reel 4.
Mr. Forbes, Reel 4. You mentioned firing on the range. How often did that take place in the territorial?
Well, in the miniature range, it was normally every we trained every week, of course, in the drill hall. First of all, there were quite a few compulsory sessions of firing on the miniature range, 0.22. There was also open for general practice amongst yourselves, and also, of course, we had an awful lot of silver cups for which we competed. So there's always plenty of practice on the miniature range. But when it came to the firing live ammunition on the open range, of course, governments being as stingy as they were, there's a very, very limited supply of ammunition. So we only had normally one good practice just before we went to camp, and we used to go down to Whitburn to fire on the Whitburn ranges there. And I had one very interesting experience. There was a chap firing at the range, and I was the officer in charge of the firing party, and all of a sudden one of the chaps firing took an epileptic fit. Now, fortunately, the sergeant, who had a bit of experience, knew what to do. So I grabbed the man, jumped on him, took his rifle away from him, and then, of course, he'd swallowed his tongue, and he was thrashing about like a mad thing. So I kept on the man, jumped on him. The sergeant got a pencil, forced it between his teeth, and forced his jaw open, got his tongue out, start slapping his face, and having flung the rifle away, and I was still lying on him. And then eventually, when the man came round, he didn't know a blooming thing about it. And yet, when they join up, they sign a form to say, I am not subject to epileptic fits. Now, if that had been a machine gun, and he started spraying around like that, because we were doing a Lewis gun practice as well after that, but it was a rifle, fortunately. But that was an episode there. And then we used to start off firing. We'd start off at 50 yards, then 100, then 250, and then 5, then finally 600 yards target on the range. And then if you're on duty in the butts, we'd have what we used to call snap shooting, which was very important training, because when you're in warfare, Jerry's not going to just say, well, right, old chaps, here I am, you better start firing at me. He's going to bob up, fire his bit, and then get down again. So what the officer had to do in the butts, he had to control the chap. He used to have a long pole with a black disc gun, and then the target, of course, right up above you. Then he would suddenly say, right, up, and you put your disc up on the pole, and the poor chap at the on the firing range would have to try and hit that little disc, you see, and then down again. And we'd give, I think it was 2 or 3 seconds sometimes, even less, you see, or keep varying the time. So that meant the chap got used to the idea of up, correct aim, fire, down. And he used to say, well, what a waste of time. But you see, it wasn't in the end, because the enemy's not going to wait for you. So, of course, that was the sort of training we did. But at 600 yards, it was pretty difficult to hit the target accurately.
Did you feel that you reached a reasonable level of proficiency with the rifle before the war started?
Oh, yes. Well, the whole battalion, you see, had a long tradition of being good shots. And particularly amongst the officers, they prided themselves on being as good as, if not better than the other ranks. So, of course, they would take their cue from us, you see. So we had some very, very good shots. Then, of course, there would be inter-company or even inter-battalion competitions as well, you see. So, basically, the Durhams were, well, of course, they had to be jolly good shots, and we had a very good standard. But, like everything else, we lacked ball ammunition. There just wasn't enough to go around. But there was plenty of .22, funny enough, which was nearly good enough for the real thing. Once you got used to the kick of the ball ammunition, it was straightforward. Get it well tucked into your shoulder, squeeze the trigger, hold your breath, and off you goes. Reload! So that's
where were you in war when you heard that war started, when the invasion came over?
I happened to be in the office that day in Newcastle, and all of a sudden a telegraph boy rode up on a red telegraph bicycle, burst into the office with a telegram, delivered to me, and all it said was, Forbes, you'll report to Bladen Drill Hall at once, signed, signed Campbell Slide, Captain. And I had to literally drop everything I had, get on my motorbike, I had a motorbike then, go home, get into uniform. My mother's at work, and my grandmother's at home with her daughter, and I can still see them now. I rode off on my motorbike, completely with all my uniform, of course, and there they were with the tears streaming down their cheeks saying goodbye to me. And my mother never saw me again until I got a bit of leave just before we went overseas. But that's why I was just a telegraph boy. And you know, by around about 10 or 12 o'clock at night at the Blit drill hall, nearly everybody in that company had turned up. They just literally dropped their pick in the pit, you know, dropped their pen in the office or whatever it happened to be, and there we were already, which was quite remarkable on the first day.
This was the 3rd of September, was it?
No, the 1st. You see, we were called up on the 1st of September because they knew the news was coming, you see. And on the 1st of September, we were called up. Then the next day, the battalion, in fact, the whole brigade, I think, moved down to Whitburn for a further sort of gathering together and a bit of ball ammunition practice, of which Colonel Henderson, our CO, our old First World War colonel, was there. And then we marched down to Sunderland, because from the 1st of September, they thought that the Germans would bomb, and particularly with gas bombs, that bomb all the ports. So the 9th Battalion was sent to Sunderland to protect the port as well they could, but to prevent civil disorder. You know, a military rule would be imposed straight away. But of course it didn't happen. So there we were, 1st of September, church parade in a church, and all of a sudden the clergyman stopped the service. I have to announce that Great Britain is now at war with Poland. And that's how it all started. And this was before we went down on the 1st of September. This was on the 3rd of September, first church parade.
Which church was that?
Ooh, I can't remember now. It was a Church of England church.
In Sunderland?
In Sunderland. We were posted to Sunderland. That was our duty, you see, because they thought the Germans would, you know, smash all the ports up. In fact, if they pulled their thumb out properly, they could have left a much better war than they did, the Germans. But there you are, that's by the way. So that was the reason why we went to Sunderland, of all places.
Civilians, parents and relatives must have thought in terms of the First World War.
They did, you see. And this idea was so ingrained about gas. Everywhere we went, we had to wear our respirators. And then we'd do exercises, of course, in respirators, which was a pretty horrible business. I mean, they get very hot and sweaty inside. You couldn't see where you were going. And it was a horrible business. But you see, we had to continue with our training, you see, assuming that gas had dropped.
Had you assumed command of the carriers by this time?
Well, I don't know about assumed. No. Bill Robinson originally was in charge of the one carrier we had. He was then promoted to company commander, HQ company commander, and Forbes was selected and said, right, Forbes, one carrier, you're in charge. And that was it. So I knew nothing at all about carriers, how to drive them, what they were for, or anything. So I just had to learn the hard way. But that was the way it went. But because I could drive a car and drive a motorbike, of course, I soon got the hang of it, and that was how I came to do it.
Did you like the carrier?
Yes, I did. It was a remarkable weapon, I think, in many ways, and it's the pre-runner, of course, of armoured personnel carriers, which they have today, you see. The only difference is they're much bigger, better armed, and got a lid on, whereas ours weren't very well armed, had no lid on, and you're exposed to all the weather. But when when I first took over command of the carrier platoon, we had one carrier which was called Donald Duck. Nobody showed me how to drive it at all. It was just literally in the yard, and they said, "Well, there it is, Forbes. Do what you can with it." So I had to learn all about the control, how to drive it. And I was transferred from Bladen Drill Hall to Gateshead, where the headquarters were. And the first few nights we slept in the local bowling club house. And when we woke up the next morning, I said to one of my pals, "Ah, that's funny. We've had some visitors during the night, and you know we've been flea bitten all over. We're absolutely ridden with fleas." So that's the thing I remember about that place: just fleas in Prince Consort Road. It was astounding. So that's how I learned about the carrier. And of course, it's not like driving a car, because you turn the wheel slightly to the left, which puts the brakes on the left-hand track, and before you know where you are, you've slewed round like that. So what you had to do, of course, you tickle to the left, tickle to the right, and hope you're going to go straight. which of course is the way you drive a tank.
What was its role?
The role was support for infantry companies in your own battalion who wanted extra power fire quickly. But to get that extra power, you had to travel across enemy fire to get to them. This, of course, is why they were born in the first place, you see, because this had happened in the First World War. You couldn't get the power supply quick enough. So that's why the carriers came in. So we had to train ourselves to move quickly from A to B, to leap out with the Bren and a rifle, with the ammunition, get in a position and start firing. And that's the sort of basic idea. And whilst the armour plating would stop rifle fire, of course, it was no good against anti-tank weapons at all, but never mind. It was a good concept, and they were very versatile weapons, of course. You could load anything onto them and they would carry it. And there was a wonderful engine. It was taken out of the Ford V8 Pilot motor car before the war. Completely overpowered from the car point of view, but from our point of view, it was absolutely marvellous, because you could flog it with your foot flat on the floor, scream its head off, take your foot off, and it would just start ticking over. It was a wonderful engine. And, of course, it was the only car manufacturer who could make them in such quantities. And Ford got the job, and they were absolutely marvellous engines. Ford V8 engine, I always remember.
What was the crew?
There was the driver. There's a driver, a sergeant sitting beside him, and another man on the back. But it was divided into three sections. There was the platoon commander, three sergeants in charge of three carriers, and each carrier was in charge of a corporal. And then, of course, he had another rank behind him, sitting in the rear seat. So you always had plenty of NCOs to take over. You see, you had to work on your own initiative an awful lot, because if, say, a company say, I want a bit of help here, it might have to be... Stop. So, for example, if you have the whole of the carrier platoon giving it support, say, perhaps two other companies, you could only spare one carrier to go and do that particular job. So obviously, if the man hadn't been trained to be on his own initiative, you wouldn't get anywhere at all. So because you had an NCO with a reasonable amount of experience in charge, he could go off on his own, do the job, and then rejoin the rest of the platoon. So of course, that earlier training of making each man responsible right down the line for taking initiative, that of course is where the real strength came in wartime conditions, but of course you can't wait for everything to be just tickety-boo before you start moving off. So that's how it was done. And of course with the carriers, we could always carry an awful lot of ammunition on the back. We had, or even more, ammunition boxes as well as our magazines. So of course it was very, very heavy, high firepower, which could be brought to bear very, very quickly indeed. And then of course once we'd done the job, we could reform ready for the next job. So really, the concept of the carry was a very sound one and worked out very well in practice, except we could have done with slightly better armour plating and perhaps a little better anti-tank protection. Because even within our own battalion, later on, we got an anti-tank gun as a separate artillery detachment. It was only a 2-pounder, whereas the Germans had very, very powerful weapons. Ultimately, we got a 6-pounder. But then again, you see, the Germans had jumped ahead with the 135mm gun, and we're always miles behind all the time. So ultimately, whatever they may say, it comes back to the poor old burning infantry, you see, at the end of the scale. But that was how the carrier platoon worked.
Was it a Bren gun per carrier, hence the called Bren
each carrier? Each carrier had one Bren gun, one boy's anti-tank rifle, and of course your rifles. And of course the officer always had his pistol, but Forbes being Forbes, I had a rifle as well, always fully loaded, ready for long distance. Well, I mean, a pistol's no good for 200 yards. So I managed to borrow a rifle, that's how I put it that way.
You were there given a carrier and a duty of forming a carrier platoon. How did you do it?
Well, the first thing, I had 30 men who were completely clueless. So I first of all had to show them by standing around how to work the controls. Then get a man in, one at a time, give him a ride, show him what I was doing, get out, say, get in, this is in a field, of course, and see what sort of a hash he made of it. Then I'll go through them all, and I'll read out those that I thought were going to shape up fairly quickly, and those that I could see were going to be terribly hard work, because obviously they had no idea at all. So what I would do is I'd put the good ones to one side just to watch, but the dud ones I'd take literally by myself. I would sit on the one side and put him in the driving seat and literally tell him what to do. Grab the wheel, press the clutch out, move the accelerator, move the gear lever, take the foot off the accelerator, move the gear lever, let the clutch out gently, and so on. And after some terrible starts, of course, they gradually, by repeat, got the idea. And then I put him to one side and take another man. You see, realize with one carrier and one instructor who's not really properly trained in instruction, the job we had, but you see, we had to get it done. And then, of course, eventually, when the duds had got up to the pretty well to the level of those that could drive, we began to go through the whole thing again and again and again. So get in, get started, move across to that side of the field, turn round, come back, get out, get your gun set up, get back in the carry, and so on. And eventually, through that simple system of bang, 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 they got the idea. And then, of course, eventually, manna from heaven, very shortly before we were shipped overseas, what does the government do, of course? 10 carriers all in a bunch, 10 Bren guns, 10 anti-boys rifles, plenty of ammunition, pistols for the officers. We didn't know what to do with ourselves. But there again, you see, this was the situation in the country. So each driver then, of course, took charge of his own particular carrier, and all the two other men joined them. And then, of course, very shortly, we began to form a homogeneous unit. Unfortunately, there wasn't sufficient time to work together as a battalion with the carriers, doing field exercises, very, very vigorous ones at that, whereby the ideas which was learned in a sort of static sense were brought into action in a mobile sense. So, of course, we were pretty well prepared by the time we moved across to France. Let's have a drink.
So how many carriers would form the carrier platoon?
Three sections of three, that's nine, and one for the carrier commander, that's me. And in my own carrier, I had my batman and my driver, who was a corporal. So there's the driver on the right, I was on the left, and my batman was behind me on the rear. And then each section of carriers of three had a sergeant in charge, and each carrier had a corporal. So, of course, we had a very heavy sprinkling of NCOs, but for obvious reasons, because they'd have to learn, and did learn, how to operate on their own without any direct supervision from the officer. So that's how they were organised.
Were there accidents in the training and in the use of carriers?
No. Interesting enough, the only time there was a bit of a scrape was when I was driving the company commander back to headquarters at this sort of country house they were living in. And I was driving, as it happened, from the farmhouse where we were bulleted up the main road. And, of course, being a young officer, I suppose I was showing off a little bit. This gate was rather narrow. So, of course, Forbes, instead of slowing down slightly, kept up his speed, you see, and belted through what he thought was between the two gateposts. Of course, instead of which, I caught the left-hand gatepost. And, of course, the company commander gave me a right old rollicking for not driving carefully, you see. So I haven't forgotten that. But there were marvellous things on a decent road that could do 40 to 45 miles an hour. And across a field, you can do 30, 35 quite easily, fully loaded, with all ammunition and guns and personnel. So they were quite a good vehicle. Very, very fast indeed. But, of course, they only had one snag. They made a terrible noise. So, of course, as soon as the Germans heard this noise, they thought there were tanks, of course, and they were ready for us.
When you were actually training the drivers, were there any hair-raising escapades with those?
Yes, well, of course, there were always breakdowns and scrapes and bumps. You see, at the time, the army had a pretty generous view of this. Whatever damage you did, the farmer didn't care, because you just put in the bill for all the walls and gateposts and things were damaged. It was just sort of general damage. There wasn't any sort of serious accident, because I started with 30 men and finished with 30, so it must have been all right from that point of view. Apart from that time we were skidding down that hillside and finished up against a tree. But I have forgotten to mention, each platoon had a regular army mechanic attached. Now this is important to make sure that the engines, but in particular, were kept up to scratch, and also the tracks, because of course the tracks used to wear out quite rapidly, and pins used to come out or snap. So you had to learn how to brace up the track, put a new pin in or a new link in, and then get on the way again. Of course, we didn't know how to do that. So this is where these army mechanics came in. They also kept the engines in tip-top condition as well, you see, such as making sure the points were clean, the plugs were clean. But I used to drill into my men, POW to you, before I'd allow them to go to bed or to break off, petrol, oil, water. If you didn't check those three things before you broke off, Forbes were on their bones. Because it was so important that if you got a call in the middle of the night to get off and fight somewhere or do something, it's no use saying, oh, Sarge, I haven't got any petrol, can you wait a minute? So I used to be very unpopular because I used to make them do that before they broke off at the end of the day. So that's when I was unpopular. But again, it comes back to respect. They knew that what I was telling them to do was for their own good. So that's the way I did that bit.
And obviously you became quite proficient as a...
Well, actually, the adjutant ticked me off once. I suppose quite right in the way, but Forbes being informed, I said, look, I want to understand how all these things work in case I'm stuck by myself. So if the mechanic was doing something interesting or something difficult, I was there with an overall on, doing the same job myself. So that if he wasn't there, something happened, I could go on and say, right, I know what's wrong with that one, you see. But the adjutant wasn't, he was brought up in the old school. The officers didn't do that sort of thing, but I was slightly different. I wanted to understand myself how it worked, because in wartime you haven't got time to call up for a mechanic or to call for anybody else to help you, or the AA, for instance. So that's how it is. So I made myself really competent in understanding what was going on.
Did you carry spares on each carrier?
The only spare we did carry, I think, three or four links, several link pins. It was the pins that always went because they wore out, you see. Because you see the it's interesting with track vehicles. The track isn't driving the vehicle. The track is laid down, and the tank is moving along the track at that distance, and then it picks it up again. That's the theory, you see. And the pins were always going. So, of course, when they snap, it's a devil of a job. You've got to pick this great big heavy track, try and get it together, get them to make like that, and drive your pin in, you see, ready to move on again. So you had this sort of claw arrangement, where you had to sort of press up like that, and bring the links together and get your pin knocked in. So that's what the mechanic was teaching us how to do, you see. But I wanted to make sure I knew how to do it, so I could show the men.
On average, how long would it take to take an old pin out, a damaged one out, and put a new one in?
Oh, well, once you got really, really well trained, about 10 to 15 minutes, if not less. But it was hard physical work, you see, because, you see, the track would thrash all over the place. You had to get both ends, lift the whole weight of the track up, bring it all together, underneath, because the canopy sort of came over the track. You had to get underneath like this, get them all together, and then belt it in with a hammer, you see. So it was quite hard work. But we got it down to around about 10 to 15 minutes to get a track reading in.
Can we turn now to something that you mentioned that we haven't talked about? You've mentioned having a batman, as which every... Oh,
well, we used to call them servants in the ninth.
How did you choose, or were you given someone, or did you have the opportunity to choose?
Well,
someone?
I was I think it was the 2IC, Major Caddy said, right, you can, from your own platoon, you can choose somebody who you think will be suitable for you to be your batman during camping, and of course when the war started. So I chose this chap, Dixon. He was a marvellous fellow, as rough as they make them, like the old pint of beer and so on. But loyal and honest, hard-working, and all the other qualities that you look for in a bloke. He was absolutely marvellous. And I had him, of course, right until the time I was wounded. And if it hadn't been for him, of course, I wouldn't have got out at all. And I think I sent you those notes, didn't I, where I recommended him later on for the military medal, you see. Because quite often when I was reorganising the rest of the platoon, he would sort of take over the Bren gun with Corporal Howe, who was my driver, and do the necessary firing that was needed to be done whilst I was organising the rest of the platoon, you see. So I had to rely upon an awful lot. But
the batman did have a very important role to play.
He had a personal role to play. He also had a military role to play as well, you see. He was really in charge of where to place the gun, how to fire it and so on, whereas the driver was only there to ferry ammunition from the carrier to Dixon, where he was firing with the gun, you see, whilst I was doing other jobs, you see.
What did he do for you as on a personal nature?
He looked out at my clothes, washed my clothes, see that I had the right uniform for the right job, you see. I'd say, right, it's a route march tomorrow, Dixon. What do my boots and socks look like? That sort of thing, you see. Then if there was a guest night, is your mess kit okay? You know, give me a good brush down, make sure I was clean and tidy. He had to see to all my personal requirements. And, of course, the bedding and all the rest of it. But then again, no question of looking down to him. He was something performing a specific duty of man to officer and officer to man. That's how it was done. And he was absolutely marvellous. And
what was the thinking behind it? Was it because an officer is too busy to be looking after all
the thinking behind it is that an officer, when duty for the day is finished, the other ranks sit back, play cards, have a drink, do what they like. When it finishes with an officer, you've got to think about the next day. So you've got to start planning, reading maps, organizing ammunition, exercise, whatever it happens to be. His work is never finished until he goes to sleep. So that's the reason for it. So whilst he's doing the thinking work, the servant is doing the, are his boots ready? Has he got the right sort of uniform? Has he got his rifle and so on, you see? That's the idea behind it, you see. Not that because we're not capable of doing all the jobs ourselves, but we have a dual job to do, which was preparing for the next step ahead, you see.
Did he get extra pay for this task?
No, he's just paid an ordinary soldier. The only pay he got, I suppose, I gave him a tip now and again and food and all the rest of it, and like to treat him kindly and all the rest of it, but he wasn't paid. He wasn't treated any special at all for anybody other than the platoon.
Might they be called into the mess to do jobs and then for any given?
Oh yes, day? yes. Or if the cooks or the catering people want an extra help, you know, can you spare Dixon to come give us a hand? You see, so Dixon would trog along and do that for them. But it was a personal thing. You see, in the carry, I always used to carry I had a stove, an OXO cube, and if the opportunity presented itself, I'd say, right, come on, Dixon, what about a brew up? You see. So you get the stove going and put an OXO cube and have an OXO, you see. All those sort of personal things. But first of all, he was a fighting soldier. That was the idea. And he had to do it on his own without any guidance from me because I was doing something else. But you see, that's the strength of the British Army.
So 3rd of September, you were in the church in Sunderland when the announcement was made.
That's right.
What was the what happened after that?
We assembled. We went down to Whitburn firing ranges, did a short firing course. The colonel of the regiment, Colonel Henderson, came round to wish us goodbye, and then we all entrained or took a bus, or in my case my motorbike, and we all went down to the Cotswolds.
When would this be?
That was, let's see, the third. It would be round about the mid September. We weren't very long in Sunderland, because the pressure was so great to get training, you see. And the only sort of reasonable training grounds was the Cotswolds, as far as we were concerned. So that's when we went round to the Cotswolds. So it'd say around mid-September, 39.
How were you received down there?
Well, first of all, not received at all. I mean, country folks cut off in a beautiful part of the country. Suddenly, all these rough, hard miners and others and officers and so on appeared from county down, Gateshead, Ferring. Where's that, you see? So, of course, they were hostile at first. And then when they found out what we're really like, of course, it was completely changed. And by the time we left, of course, in January, it was the other way around. You know, bags of tears coming back, come and see us again and so on, you see. So it was a complete change around in a way.
Whereabouts in Cotswold were you billeted?
Well, we were stationed at Morton and Marsh, headquarter company. We had others at shipping. I think C Company went to shipping Camden. There was shipping Norton. We were on the borders of where 8th Battalion were. But I was at Morton and Marsh. It's a lovely part of the country. And we were billeted on. Shall I tell you about this farmhouse we were billeted on? Well, it was an isolated farmhouse. There was the farmer, his wife, 5 daughters, 2 sons, and 4 officers, all crammed into this one house. So you can imagine the reaction of the farm wife when she was told, you weren't asked, you were told. Major Kelly knocked on the door, said, oh, I'm putting 4 officers in this farmhouse, all right. And that was the end of that. So there was the five daughters, two sons, a husband, a farmer and his wife, and 4 of us, all jammed into this farmhouse. Now, the arrangements were very interesting. First of all, there was no running water. So the water had to be pumped from the cellar by hand up into a tank in the roof. And that was trickled down through an ancient pipe into a sink, you see. No electricity, so of course everything was lit by oil lamps. There was no gas at all. And the toilet arrangements also were interesting too, because it was an outside toilet and it was a two-seater. So of course, when you were doing your business, you could have a chat at the same time. It was very, very convenient. But you see, they regarded that as quite normal, whereas we were a bit taken aback. But never mind, it's like everything else in the army. You just get used to it.